So Rabbi Kalman asked me to make something here that on the one hand would have a lot of Jewish content, but on the other hand would also be accessible to the average Jewish businessman. Now, this is a business person, rather. This is meant to be kind of a boardroom kind of thing that would be accessible to any Jewish business person in Toronto. And so we're going to have the sources, but the sources are going to be in English. We're going to read them. We're going to study them. And I think that we have everyone signed in, and we can just go right ahead and start. Okay? I'll just explain briefly that the case studies we're doing here, most of them are based on a series of trigger films that we made at our center. I'm the research director at the Business Ethics Center of Jerusalem, and we made a series of trigger films for for business ethics dilemmas and source sheets that go around them. And these trigger films were also designed, like the series of lectures, the trigger films were designed specifically for a more general audience, but then trying to really apply the Jewish sources to them. And so I thought it was an ideal thing. Unfortunately, if we were to show the films themselves, it would take a lot of time out of the lecture, but a lot of work was put into making a very interesting case study. And one of the things that we're always emphasizing in all of our case studies and all of my columns and so on is to find things that are truly dilemmas. In other words, we're not going to say what's wrong with this or what's right with this. I'm always striving to find things that there's something to be said on both sides, and so we have a genuine dilemma to face. And so let's go. So this is called Stretching the Truth, and we'll see immediately why. Okay, let me see if I can get to the next slide. How does that work? Here it is. Case study part one. Okay, the basis of this case study is a scenario which is extremely common in high tech. Normally, when you're in a regular business and you have a customer who says, I want product X, so you have it, in inventory, you have it in production, you know exactly what the customer wants, he's seen it, maybe he's used it, you have it to offer him, and so there's not really much of a problem of a meeting of the minds of what really they're getting. The problem is that in high tech, people are always stretching their abilities, they're always challenging themselves, and they're always promising products that don't exist. That sounds very sneaky. It sounds very unethical. But even the customers understand that they are getting a product that has only a prototype. There may be still some bugs left. And so the very fact that the product doesn't exactly exist and it's in the pipeline doesn't automatically make it unethical if that's the expectation of the customer. At the same time, it opens the door for a lot of mischief and a lot of misunderstanding between the people. And what we have, so we would take one extreme where producer has a product, they already have a prototype, they may have some glitches in the production line, but they can see their way clear to all different problems that would arise, and are absolutely certain that they can provide the product. That seems perfectly okay. And at the other extreme is something where, it's a wing and a prayer that they may be able to produce it, which would certainly seem unethical to promise it. And what we have very often is something in between. There's a lot of glitches. There's a few things that we don't know exactly how we're going to solve them. But in the past, we solved these problems. People in high tech have big egos. They have a lot of confidence in themselves. They're pretty sure they're going to solve it. And they're kind of representing maybe a little more than what they have. And this is kind of a common thing. So the case study that we have is where we have a case like this. We have a technology. The technology is basically good. It seems, like it was going to suit the customer, but there's still a few things missing. And the salesperson wants to now go and present the client with a spec sheet, a specification sheet, which is going to show that the product does exactly what the client wants it to do. But really, it doesn't. So the salesperson comes to the engineer and says, all I want from you is a spec sheet, right? Let's read the thing. Your problem is that the client is coming tomorrow and I need a revised technical data file I can sell with. Right? You are the engineer. It is your job to make these technical things happen, right? The engineer says, we're getting there, right? We're trying to emphasize this in our script. The technology is there, but we're not there yet, right? The technical data file that's coming out will be stretching the truth, right? This is the key thing of our scenario here, is it's something called stretching the truth. Right? It's not something that's an outright lie. He has a certain confidence that he can get there, but that's not where the thing is right now. Right? And so the salesperson, this is lovely. We're very happy with the people who have these meetings. Trigger Films for us. They wrote a great script. So what's stretching the truth? He says the truth, but bigger, right? So what we have basically here is the salesperson is saying, look, you just give me the file. You're not doing anything wrong because all you're doing is giving me a file. You're not vouching for the file. I'm going to take care. I'm going to use the file to sell. Right? And the salesperson also feels okay because she didn't make the data file. She got it from the engineer. And in this way, they're going to try and each one divvy up the blame and responsibility. Each one is going to hopefully, the idea is each one will feel okay. But let me see if I can go ahead now. Okay. And in this way, they're going to make the sale. Now, when I presented about 2 years ago, I presented this case study at an evening in Manhattan, and there were some business people there, not from the high-tech business. And they were very unhappy. They said, Rabbi Meir, you're claiming to give things that are really dilemmas, but this is not a dilemma at all. This is something that's so crooked that no honest firm would ever do it, and it's a black and white case. And so I was a little upset about that. And afterwards, I found that these people who are from the financial markets have a different standard. You know, you can usually pretty much tell a person exactly what the product is, and they're not familiar. But in fact, I was able to come up with an example from a very, very reputable firm who had a very similar situation. And we see these things can happen. This is a Wall Street Journal article from a few years ago. Sycamore Network, which is a digital switch company, was trying to come up with the best digital switch. And they contracted to purchase lasers from Infineon, which is a very well-known German firm that had recently been spun off from Siemens. In other words, this is not some little fly-by-night company. This is a large company with a pedigree, and they had a contract to provide these lasers. Sycamore knew the lasers didn't exist yet, but they expected to receive all the glitches to be worked out, and the product to arrive at a certain time. All of a sudden, right, so I'm going to read out the last at the end of this thing, right? Infineon sales represented throughout last summer. This is already from 7 years ago. Infineon sales represented a promise sticking with the faster lasers would be on time, finished on time by early fall. Then Mr. Swans received an ominous email from the representative intending that Infineon might not even be able to build the fast lasers. That's just a question of a delay. The thing would not be able to exist at all. What that means is when they promised it, they just didn't have all the glitches worked out, because if they did, then it wouldn't all of a sudden come out that they couldn't produce it. Right? So here we see that Infineon was... They're not lying. They weren't trying to cheat Sycamore, but they were apparently exaggerating where they were in the development process. And so, in fact, later on, I called these companies. There was no lawsuit as a result of this. I actually contacted the company to see if they'd give me more details that I could use it as a case study, in college and so on. They didn't want to comment, right? At one stage, at least in the high tech life cycle, this is kind of business as usual, and I don't think that it's really okay, but it shows you that it's not something that would seem to be within the high-tech world would be so black and white. I'm going to welcome Michael. Michael, can you hear me? If you can, you can either speak on the mic or you can type in the chat window. Okay, great. And the other thing I'm going to ask you, Michael, is if you can see the PowerPoint on the right-hand side of your screen. Great. Okay, so I'm going to only make a very brief recapitulation for Michael. I'm sorry for the others, but there's really only three of you, so please bear with me. We're talking about a case where a high-tech company, it's a common that a high-tech company promises a product that is almost ready. And the customers know this, and the question is how ready is almost ready, and we're taking a case study where the almost ready is the engineers are pretty sure that in 3 months they'll be able to do it, but they're not quite 100% sure, and the salespeople are pressuring them to produce a specification sheet for what they think is going to happen. It's not something that they don't think they're going to be able to do, so they're not trying to lie. But on the other hand, they're kind of exaggerating where they're holding, and it sounds certainly very ugly. But I'm pointing out that the high-tech world is unique, a unique part of the market where people are always trying to get things that are a little better, that are ahead of the curve. And there have been precedents for this kind of activity, even among reputable firms, and we're going to try and examine that using Jewish sources. Okay. So the first thing, I hope that people can now see the first source, right? The first source is from a Mishnah. We're going to examine this dilemma. We're going to examine different pieces of the dilemma, okay? The first piece of the dilemma that I am going to address is I'm going to look at the point of view of the engineer, right? The engineer is going, he is going to provide a specifications file which is exaggerated, right? That sounds like doing something that's very misleading, but the engineer, as we saw in the case study, is being straight up front with the salesperson saying, look, I want you to know that this is speculative. I think we'll be there in 3 months. We're certainly not there now. I can't be sure, right? And so he's giving something that's not quite right, but he's being quite upfront about it. And the salesperson is urging them to go ahead and say, you're doing fine. You're doing nothing wrong. It's your job to give me the spec sheet, and my job is to sell, so don't worry, right? We saw the piece of the script from our trigger film a little while ago where the salesman is trying to reassure the engineer, you do your job, I'll do my job, and you're okay, right? So the mission in Bava Metzia, right, says like this. It's like if water becomes mixed in your wine, right, the mission in general is talking about the prohibition to dilute your product, to mix water with your wine and so on, to mix old fruits with new ones and things of the nature. Then what happens if it just happens, right? You have a barrel of wine, water gets mixed in with it, you want to go and sell it, so it says don't sell it to customers, lo yikifrenu b'chanut, elim ken modiyo, you can't sell it to the customers unless you inform them. But if you inform them, you're okay, you go to the customer and say, look, in those days people were used to getting wine that was very strong, they would decant it, they would mix it with water at the table, and because the price reflected that it was very concentrated. In this case, you go to your customer and say, look, I want you to know this wine is already mixed. You don't have to add water to it. And, of course, the price is going to be less. That's perfectly fine. Then the Mishnah comes along and says, don't sell out to a merchant, even if you do inform them. Lo tagar afilu modiyo, ke'ino ilu remot. Even if you inform them, you can't sell to them because they are going to use it to mislead others. Okay? You're going to you're a wholesaler. You're going to a retailer who's used to buying concentrated wine from you. Now you're selling diluted wine, and you say to him, look, I'm going to be upfront with you, right? This is not my regular product. This is a diluted product. He says, great, right? So I know I've been honest with him. He's honest with me, and everything is fine. But the mission says that's not the case. In this case, you have a suspicion that he's going to take advantage of the fact that he can now open up a brand new barrel of wine for his customers and reassure them that it's uncut. And now you're, in effect, helping him deceive his own customers. You're honest with him, but he's not honest with his customers, and you now bear some of the responsibility. So what I'm going to suggest is that this applies to our engineer. The engineer cannot assuage his conscience by saying, okay, I'm being honest. I'm giving this person a specification sheet. I'm telling him exactly what it means, exactly what it's worth. This is something that's speculative. It's hopeful. It's months ahead of its time. And I explain what it is. The fact that you produce this and it has your stamp on it, so to speak, you know that they're going to use that to mislead somebody else, which in this case is the customer. And so this is one aspect of the case study that I think we can find interesting parallel for to say, you know, this idea of divide and conquer, where each person does only a little bit. The engineer thinks he's safe because he didn't tell the customer anything, and the salesperson thinks she's okay because she only gave the customer this specification sheet they got from the engineer, so it doesn't really work that way. Okay, so let's go ahead now.
I've got a question. On the engineer in this instance, or is it on the salesperson? Does the sales Can the engineer simply say to the salesperson, you disclose, you know, or does he actually have to formally disclose it as well?
He has to. In this case, that's a very good question. I want to encourage people to ask questions. This is one of the nice things about this technology. We have this mega meeting technology of all this bit, is that even though I'm sitting here in Efrat in Israel and you guys are sitting in Toronto, this is an interactive technology. Please ask questions whenever you like. And so the answer is, the way I see it, the way the Mishnah puts it, and the way I see it, it doesn't say that you have to obtain a promise from the merchant that he's going to inform his customers. The answer is you have to refrain from selling him the wine. Right? There's no way that if you could really get a binding promise, that would be one thing. But, you know, it's not enough. It's, oh, don't worry, I'll be fine. You know, people, that's not going to help. In this case, the responsibility of the engineer is to refuse to give the salesperson a misleading specification sheet. His name is signed on it. It's got a significant danger. It's going to be used to mislead somebody. And just as in the Mishnah says, don't sell him the wine at all. Here the answer is going to be, don't give him the specification sheet. Okay. Somebody okay. So Gil asks privately, but I'm going to tell you, he says, can I inform the customer there's an inferior product and the price is reduced? The answer is definitely yes. That's what the Mishnah means when it says if the water comes looking you wine, don't sell to customers without informing them. If you're selling directly to the end user, you inform them, you can do whatever you want, right? the problem is only when you're selling to merchant, he's going to go ahead and sell it, and now he's going to mislead the customer. That's where the problem arises. You don't have contact here with the end user. The end user doesn't have contact with the customer in our little case study, and that's where the problem arises. Okay, that's the answer to Gil's question. Okay, the other question we're going to answer bring some sources for, is exactly how sure you have to be when you make a promise. Right? You can promise to sell something. You know there's a famous story of you sell the pelt and then you go and hunt the bear. So that's obviously something very speculative. Then there may be something in between where you're absolutely, you know, then what, then assuming you already have the product, what exactly do we draw the line here? So there's a passage, a sugya in Bava Metzia called Mechusar Amana. What happens if a person commits to a sale, technically a person says, okay, well, I sold you something, but there's no kinyan. Right? I see here that a lot of the people involved are, you know, the Rabbi Kelman told me this is meant for balabatim, for regular business people. I see people have a certain amount of Jewish background. So what's going to happen if we go fast forward to the day when the customer says, okay, where is the product that you promised me? And our salesman says, oh, sorry, we thought we would provide it, but we can't. Right? Is there anything wrong with that? Right? They're not taking any money. Right? He said, oh, you give your money back. We don't have the product. But the same thing that happened with Infineon. He said, oh, we thought you had the latest. We don't. You know, we're sorry. Is that enough? So the Gemara has a case called the Chusar Aman, someone who's unreliable, untrustworthy. Right? That's a person who enters into an agreement, and in the end he has to retract. Okay? This is not an exact parallel to here, because here they don't mean to just go back on themselves because they don't feel like it, because they can't. But it gives an idea that the person who is not having a full commitment behind what he does is untrustworthy. And I have another point to it now, and another source that I'm calling the Taza, to raise the Haz commentary, where he talks about a situation which is extremely similar to our situation. In fact, it's remarkable parallel. It talks about a person who stopped by in a certain town. He had a very valuable, he was going to a certain place to try and acquire a certain kind of jewel. And the person says there, oh, don't go ahead to where you were going to go. Don't go to the marketplace you're going to go. You stay here, I'll acquire it for you. right? And so the person did. He relied on that. And the person went out and he made his best effort to go out and find. He thought he knew a person who had a jewel, a pearl in the case of the appropriate description. The person was not just outright dishonest, right? He really said he really thought he knew somebody who had the product. He said, "Don't worry, you just stay here." He went out. He found that he couldn't apply his oath. Sorry, was he okay because he thought that he was doing the right thing? The answer is no. The other person relied on him. He didn't go to another customer. That's parallel to our situation here, where the customer says, "I'm not going to go to another supplier. I'm going to rely on you." And so this is a case of someone who is basically inducing reliance above and beyond what he's really promised. And this is another source I'm going to bring. I'm going to go short on this one because we have a lot of sources still to go.
Is there a concept of seeking damages if, in fact, you did rely on it?
It would be hard. I'll just answer this briefly. There's a certain kind of reliance that had maybe damages of Garmi. The Gemara in Bava Kama talks about a case where a person goes to a money changer, and the money changer, whose professional job it is to tell people if a coin is good or not, he says it's good. If it turns out that he made a mistake and the customer accepted it in payment, it's like clearing a check and there's no bad behind it, so the bank has to stand behind it. So there also you have to stand behind it. This is considered causing a loss. But here it would be hard to demonstrate a loss because there was a clear loss. I accepted this coin. In this case, the seller would be hard-pressed to prove that this reliance caused a loss because they didn't accept any payment, they didn't put out any money. So it's not something that we couldn't invent a scenario, but basically this would be a case where it would be hard to establish a case for damages. Okay? I'm going to move ahead to the other thing. Again, we tried to present these case studies so they have a variety of different dilemmas. And one of the dilemmas is like this. Anyone who's ever worked in high tech knows that the people they have a lot of confidence, right? If you go and ask to the head of this high tech company, how could you go ahead and lie to your customer and tell him this thing is okay, right? You're totally dishonest. He would say, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, do I want to put my reputation on the line?" Right? What happens when this company comes out, if it really works out, that the product is not there? Right, the company's reputation is ruined. Right, they have an angry customer. They're going to have trouble finding new customers. They may, in secular law, open themselves up to a lawsuit. Right, so he thinks that he's only telling them what he really believes. Right, this boss is a confident guy. He is absolutely sure. He trusts. He has a lot of faith in his workers and his technology. He is confident that he really will be able to provide the goods. Right? So what's wrong with that? He's, I'm sure I can. So what I want to point to the fact is the difference between telling a person, "I'm positive I can help you," and that's one thing, and the other hand, trying to adduce external evidence to supposedly support your claim. Right? At the one hand, the boss comes along and says, he tells the salesperson, "Go ahead, tell the person we're going to do it. We want this contract. We deserve it. We'll be able to help them." Fine, that's one thing. When it comes to providing a seemingly objective evidence for that, all of a sudden you are in a different category. And here's a very interesting passage from Tractate Shavuot, right? It's better in Hebrew, but here it is in Hebrew. What happens like this? You have a rav, he tells a student, right? He says, "I have $1 million, I think it's Elof Dinar. I don't know, it's not dollars in the Gemara, but it's some large sum of money," right? Does the rabbi tell the student, very well that for $1 million I wouldn't make up a story, right? This is a rabbi, he's a trustworthy person, the student knows his fine midot, his fine personal integrity, and the story tells the following story. So-and-so owes me $1,000, right? I don't know, it's an Elof Dinar or whatever it is, I don't remember, me'ah, and I have only one witness. We know that in Beit Din, in order to be able to collect on a debt, we need two kosher witnesses. He says, I have only one. Right? I don't want you to lie. I don't want you to make up a story. All I want is you to accompany me to court. Right? We're going to go to court. He's going to see that I have two people with me. He's going to be frightened and say, wow, he has two witnesses. I better just fess up and pay him the money. Right? I'd be intimidating the witness. And what's the student supposed to think? He says, wow, I'm doing a wonderful mitzvah, right? Not the money that he deserves. I don't even have to lie. I don't have to say anything. All I have to do is put the fear of God in this person by appearing next to the Rebbe. And what can possibly be wrong with that? The answer is that it's not only too proper to lie about what's going on. It's improper to lie about what you know about what's going on, what kind of evidence there is. You're trying to represent the person they have evidence that they owe the money. It's not true. And I think there's an interesting parallel to here. You know, it's one thing to say we have the product, another thing to say I have objective evidence, right? That's a whole different dimension of misleading information. And so this is another dimension of the fact the person is, you know, we have to remember all along that we're not talking about a person who's a dishonest person who's trying to cheat the customer, right? Remember, this guy's probably going to go out of business if this customer doesn't get his product. He has a true belief that he's going to be helping the person, it's going to really work. But you overstep the boundaries when if you just say, well, I'm completely sure, that's one thing. When you try and adduce objective evidence, that's already misleading. Okay, I'm going to now move ahead and talk about another aspect of the case study. This is another little piece of the script. Maybe I'll get Rabbi Kelman to make another thing, but we'll actually present the movies to people. I don't know exactly how the technology will work. But this is the way the boss goes to the salesperson, right? He says, I don't care how you do it, but you will close this deal personally, right? Kate, I trust that as usual, you will keep both the company's interest and integrity in mind, right? This is a common thing, you know, someone who's been in the ethics business for a long time. You see this a lot. The boss, there's a code of ethics in the company or ethical principles. The boss wants to cover his backside. Right, he says, I want to make sure that you make this sale, and I want to make sure that you do it according to our ethical principles. When in fact, that's impossible, right? So if the sale is made, right, then he gets credit. If it turns out that there were ethical violations, he's able to say, oh, I made sure to inform them that they're not supposed to do anything improper in the contract. This is giving mixed messages, and basically what it's trying to do is trying to have the boss evade responsibility for the behavior that he's trying to induce, right? And I find interesting, we see this from just last week's Parsha, an interesting parallel to this, right? Maybe for people to remind, Avimelech comes along to Abraham, and he decides to make a truce, or a covenant with Abraham that they will not lie to each other and they will have peace between them. And Abraham agrees to this, and all of a sudden Abraham says, by the way, what about the well which your Avimelech's servant stole? So what does Avimelech say? He says, right, Abraham reproved Hochiach Avimelech regarding the well which Avimelech's servant stole. Avimelech said, I don't know who did this, nor did you inform me, nor have I heard of it until today. Right? Well, Avimelech says a lot, but what doesn't he say? What he doesn't say is, I never knew about this act. Avimelech doesn't say, I didn't know that someone stole your well. Right? He says, I don't know who did it. He says, you didn't tell me that someone did it. He says, I haven't heard of it, right? He didn't say, I didn't know what happened. What Avi Malov has done is something that's very similar to what the boss in our story he's done, right? He says, please don't tell me, right? Don't tell me anything, right? I know that my servants are going out doing a lot of mischief. They're stealing things from Abraham, right? He says, don't tell me who did it. Don't let Abraham come here and tell me what happened. And don't let me, just don't tell me about it, right? That way when Abraham comes, I can say, no, I don't know who did it. Nor did you inform me, nor did you inform today, right? Avi Malov is not exactly the example he's a person who's always making excuses. We see this also with regard to Sarah, right? He's a person who's always making excuses and not taking responsibility, and he's not presented by the Torah as a person who we want to emulate. He's giving mixed messages. The one he's trying to present himself as being a very righteous person, right? But he says, you know, it's because of B'tom Libi, B'milchum Libi. He says, I have purity of heart and purity of hands. And God says, well, I know that you have purity of hands because I didn't let you do a transgression, but purity of heart you don't have. Right? He's presented as a person who is trying to evade responsibility. And now I'm going to give another source of a different king who did the exact opposite. He was always trying to accept responsibility and not evade it. This is the, I'm sorry for the English, I think these are people who may be familiar with Hebrew, but again, this is Rabbi Kamen urged me to make something accessible to a broad audience. Yoav, who was one of David's generals, and his brother Abishai, killed Abner, another one of David's generals, because he killed Bill's brother Asahel in battle at Givon, right? There were three brothers, Yoav, Abishai, and Asahel. Asahel, maybe people remember the story, he ran after Abner. Abner urged him, don't run after me because I'm going to have to kill you. Abner was a much more experienced warrior. Asahel, for whatever reason, refused. Abner tried to run away, tried not to kill Asahel. Asahel kept on running after him. He was a great runner. And ultimately, Abner killed him. Yoav decided to take revenge. And without consulting David, it was not with David's knowledge, not with David's consent, and nothing like the case of Abimelech. And even so, what happens now? David said to Yoav, look, rent your garments, and don sackcloth and mourn before Abner, and King David followed the bier, the Aron, right? David swore, saying, so may God do to me and so more, but he bread or anything else till the sun set. David went and he fasted as if he personally was doing tshuva for the murder of Ner, and as opposed to Abimelech, who tried to evade responsibility for something that he really did have knowledge of. Here we have a case of David, who was striving to accept responsibility when he really did not have responsibility. This is the kind of example that we have in Judaism for someone who is a leader who takes responsibility and doesn't try and to say one thing and hint something else in order to evade responsibility for wrongdoing. So I people who maybe remember from Gil, was it last week's shiur, where we talked about the corporate bribery, and I brought the case of Elisha and Gehazi, Elisha's valet, went and tried to get bribed from Naaman. In every one of my case studies, whenever I can, I always try to bring examples not only from halakhic sources, but examples from Jewish history, particularly from Tanakh, that will illustrate the kind of ethical principles we're trying to uphold here. Okay, we have a few minutes left. We have another few slides. Let's go ahead.
Is there an actual category of halacha that this is called? What violation is this actually called?
Again, I am trying to bring a combination of legal sources that show this is permissible and this is forbidden, and other sources that try and set an example for ethical behavior, things that may not be clearly defined a legal transgression. But, you know, I think it's pretty clear if we look at the tradition that Abimelech is presented as a person not to be emulated. You know, Rashi points out, the Torah points out, you know, Rashi points out, though, he tells the Gaon of Sholem, he says, he cries and claims, I have a pure heart and pure hands. Rashi says, no, God said to him, you don't have pure hands, you have pure heart, but the pure hands is my, the pure hands you have is all my doing, right? And we know that David HaMelech is the person who set up the dynasty that's going to go to the end of time, the person who's the example of leadership that we do want to emulate. And I think these things have a lot of importance. Okay? The last little bit of the case study is what happens now, right, when the is going to get this misleading specification sheet from the engineer. They want to submit it now to the customer and say, this is a specification sheet, right? Now the customer is going to look at the specification sheet and says, wait a minute, you know, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding what's going on here. Can you guarantee 100% compatibility? And the salesperson, well, in the trigger film, we give these alternative versions. Is the salesperson going to come clean and say, look, we can't guarantee it, but we have a lot of confidence, and we've helped sell products like this in the past? They could lie right out and say, yes, we can guarantee it, right? And then the other thing is you can give kind of what we call a weasel word, right? You can try, you can seem to be giving an answer, but actually you're not lying. Using a misleading expression, you have seen the specification sheet, right? That's one of the answers we could give, right? In the end, we open this up for discussion among the people who have seen the trigger film. How would you answer it? What do you think? Right? We bring our various Jewish sources, some of the ones you've seen, right? So what's the case of a person who doesn't lie right out, but he says something that he knows is going to be misunderstood? So we have a precedent for this in the laws of Gnevat Dat. Misleading statements, right? The context here is where we have non-kosher meat. You have Jewish butcher shops that usually sell only kosher meat. As we all know, sometimes you have trefos that happen, and then you have to sell them to goyim, right? The Gemara in Hulin explains that even when you sell trefos to non-Jews, you have to tell them it's a trefos, and the question arises, how do you tell them? So Rabbi Yehoshua said, meat for the soldiers has arrived, right? It says there, Nach Labisul of the Mechai, right? That's what we tell them. This is a bit of a cryptic expression, right? Meat for the soldiers. The Gemara asks, why don't we just say Trefa for the soldiers has arrived, right? I think we have no carry in Trefa, right? Just be, call a spade a spade. The answer is that people won't buy. It doesn't sound good to say Trefa. We hint it by saying, if meat for the soldier, ever know the average Babylonian soldier doesn't eat kosher. In that case, are you deceiving them? The answer is that this case of meat for the soldiers is so clear. There's no other possible explanation except I'm trying to inform people that it's trait. Someone doesn't understand that is deceiving themselves. Right? So if you say, going back here, you know, instead of saying, you have seen the specification, says, look, we're going to do our best, right? So the person understands you're going to do your best, but you really don't have it ready yet. If he doesn't understand, it doesn't mean it's not ready, then he's fooling himself. What does it mean we're doing our best? It means we're trying, but we're not there. You've seen this business. It seems to indicate this plain meaning of this thing is that the specification sheet reflects what I know. It's all true. And even though you haven't lied right out, right? If you say something, right, in the case of Gneva Dad, if we don't say meat for soldiers arrive, we just have a sign, and people just walk into the shop and buy kosher meat, they have a reasonable expectation that it's kosher meat. Usually the source is only kosher meat, right? You have to go out and specifically tell them, I'm sorry to tell you that it's not kosher today. It's meat for soldiers. The same thing here. Once the specialist says you have seen the specification sheet, a customer should have a reasonable expectation to believe that the specification sheet accurately reflects the reality. In that case, if you let him go away with that impression, you are fooling him. And so the answer, you know, in our, we can understand the dilemma of our manufacturer here. They want to sell a product that's not quite ready. They don't have to say, I'm sorry, we can't help you. They can tell the customer, look, we have a prototype. It's very far along. There's a few glitches. We're confident we'll overcome them, right? So that's okay, right? With high tech, you sometimes sell things they're not ready yet, and you tell people, once you go along and you go through this whole thing of trying to make your confidence that it's going to happen into the customer's confidence by using a misleading specification sheet, that's a misleading practice. The idea of trying to, the engineer giving a specification to the salesman, he says, oh, I'm just giving the salesperson okay, that's a misleading practice. He knows it's going to be misused. The idea of the boss who's going to say, look, you do whatever you have to, as long as ethical, right, is trying to evade responsibility for his underlings, where the leaders are trying to take responsibility. And so I think we have a thing that is a little bit of a dilemma. People do things like this, but I think, you know, we have some clear guidance from Jewish tradition that you have to be upfront about the situations like this.
Isn't it also a violation,
so,
in case number three, of Lifnei Iver?
Lifnei Iver is giving someone, we talked about that last week, I think, giving someone bad advice. In this case, what we did not talk about, that's a very good question. So let me tell you what the answer is, and we talked about this a little last week. Lifnei Iver is giving a person bad advice. It's in case Rashi says, a person comes to me for advice, and he says, should I sell my field and buy a donkey? And you advise him and says, Ratao Kefalov, Lexophobia, you basically are trying to go around him, right? You are presenting yourself as a impartial advisor, but really you have your own interest. This is what we call a hidden conflict of interest. It would seem from Rashi, if I go right out and say, I want you to know that I want to buy your field, and I give you, I think you should buy a field, I give you 10 reasons to sell your field and buy a donkey. Once I disclose, not a kefalah, I'm not going around him, I'm disclosing to him, look, I want to buy it. A person can always try and persuade a person to buy or sell an object once he's disclosed his interest in it. So I have my questions if this would be considered, since I disclosed my interest, I'm not saying I'm advising you to buy from us, right? That would be the case where I think you would get involved in this naive there. You would have Lifnei Iver in the case of the engineer. In fact, Rashi says in that sugiyah there that you would have Lifnei Iver if you go and you sell the wine to the reseller. The retailer is going to resell it. That's the case of Lifnei Iver. But in this part three business, since you are not pretending to be an impartial advisor, I wouldn't think that you would be involved in Lifnei Iver, but you would be definitely involved in Gnei Badat and creating an unforced reliance, maybe even worse. So I think that's the answer to the question, Bert. Is that Bert?
Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay, so I hope we'll see everybody soon. Last week we had two people this week, we have three. If everybody, you know, learned a lot, I hope you all benefited from this year. And if you did, I hope you will write back into other people. And we're going to continue. We have a series of six lectures every Thursday at 12:30, your time. And God willing, we'll be back next week with the next case study in the series.